This is the Empowered Caregiving Show, and we are with Lance Robertson discussing the Raised Family Caregiver Act and some of the goals that they're trying to bring to light through congressional support and working with family caregivers. So if we dive into goal two, Lance, that one is the way I'm reading it. It's a huge one. So we tried to just really boil it down to what its key point was, which is that we need to make family caregivers key partners with providers of healthcare and long-term services and support. The AARP, the National Alliance for Caregiving, they state that about 65% of caregivers report communicating with doctors on behalf of their family members. Yet they are not universally identified in health records, and in many systems do not have access to the electronic health records. And I also know personally, I'm going through this right now. A lot of times the hospitals can be more concerned about the legality than building a partnership or being on the team. It seems like it should be an easy fix, right? Train the medical profession to see caregivers as part of the care team. What do you think are the challenges in making this happen?
Yeah, so I think there are two issues, Kristen, and both of them are sort of longstanding difficulties. And the first does, I think, put front and center the whole PII, the personally identifiable information issue around health records and your right to privacy as an individual receiving care. And that even includes making the decisions about which family members know about your current condition and your care treatment and all those sorts of things. So tied to the first one has to be a continued emphasis on this whole person-centeredness, where we don't lose focus, even though we want to engage caregivers, we don't lose focus on the fact that this individual receiving care has rights, because we have to be careful. In far too many cases, families overstep the patient's wishes. Okay. So we just have to make sure that we strike that balance, because before too long, all of a sudden, in many examples, you know, the daughter is calling the healthcare shots for the mother, who actually is perfectly capable, but whose voice has kind of been taken away because everybody wants to support the caregiver. So right. My focus has always been on the care recipient, making sure that to the maximum extent possible, that person-centeredness remains the focus. And then I think on the second issue is just as the field of medicine modernizes and, you know, people start to embrace better ways of caring for individuals, we are seeing greater strides now than ever in making this a reality in terms of sharing this responsibility appropriately with the caregiver. So as an example, in Oklahoma, the first state to pass the BOLD Act, B-O-L-D, requires that upon discharge at a hospital, particularly for somebody that's facing dementia, they actually have to, by law, ask that individual to identify who the primary care recipient will be, primary caregiver will
caregiver.
Be.
Yep.
And then they have to involve that caregiver.
Oh, that's
and that
excellent.
Took a lot of work. And many states have now adopted that law, that language, which I think is, while very focused, is a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like being reminded that it really is supposed to be focused on the care recipient, right? And not taking their rights away. I know when I'm in the overwhelm of being the caregiver, I'm focused on what I need. And I try to respect the voice and the rights and the needs of the person I'm taking care of. But that can be challenging, because it's like, I want to be more efficient. I want to think big picture. And in theory, I can say it's important to value that person's rights. But it doesn't always necessarily get played out that way in practice. So thank you for giving me that reminder. I think it's a good one.
And I'll be honest, as a career gerontologist, Kristen, more times than I can count, families will come to me with solutions. And the first thing I'll ask is, well, what does your care recipient want? And they look at me with this blank look like, well, we haven't really asked him or her. Well, you really need to circle back and start there.
Right.
Because while you're developing solutions which seem very palatable to you, what if they don't like that? Mm-hmm. What if they don't want to move from where they're at and come live with you, as one example?
Right.
So
exactly.
That's an excellent point. And with both of us having children with intellectual disability, that you really see that a lot. You start making decisions for these folks without really finding out what it is they want. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. One other recommendation in goal two is to better engage family caregivers by using assessments to determine their ability to handle this role and what supports they need to make this caregiver-caree relationship successful. The report had mentioned that other countries are doing this. And again, this one seems kind of like an easy fix. Why do you think that we're not doing this here in the U.S.? And then how can caregivers advocate for these assessments?
Yeah, so the purpose behind the assessment is just a recognition that one size doesn't fit all. We need to make sure that in some instances, caregivers are either ill-equipped financially, or maybe they have career obligations, maybe they have child care obligations. Mm-hmm. All of that needs to be assessed, evaluated, factored in before you turn over a higher level of responsibility for elder care to that individual. And I think in our country, the struggle has always been just the cultural difference in terms of how we address elder care. You know, as you probably know, there are countries in other parts of the world where elders are respected, and actually families build future obligations around the care needs of that older adult. Here in America, for a variety of reasons, we just haven't been wired that way. I think elder care is often sort of a response, something that is addressed reactively instead of proactively. And that's where I think the secret sauce is making sure that we help Americans appreciate doing this right and being proactive about it can really create a pathway so much more manageable than if you simply just keep putting it off and kicking a can down the road. And, you know, even with perfectly healthy older adults, we encourage people to have very critical conversations now around care needs and maybe even end of life, and, you know, do all of that while the person's healthy and has great mental capacity. And that's the best time to actually have those conversations. Don't wait until everything has gone so dramatically downhill that you're just trying to pick from a whole bunch of bad options.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And something that we learned in our family. And so then I've also encouraged a lot of my friends to try to have those tough conversations.
It would be nice though, if somebody could help facilitate that, you know, if there was a good go-to person. I remember when my son turned 18 and we had to make all of these changes for him, I sent all of the information to my parents, you know, who his IRIS provider is and different things that they should know in if I was to pass. And I got a phone call like, are you okay? You know, are you dying? And I'm like, no, but this is stuff that you guys need to know. And I've put it all together and here it is. So I know sometimes those can be uncomfortable. So it would be great if there was a resource or a support around helping families have those conversations.
Yep, definitely. Goal three is about recognizing that there is a wide variety of family caregivers, right? So we have people from all different kinds of ethnic and cultural backgrounds, different ages, different, you know, I try to bring up how it tends to disproportionately fall on women, but there are plenty of men that actually end up being family caregivers as well, especially as our workforce is becoming more diverse in terms of, you know, women progressing further in their careers. So you have to make the hard choice if you have to start cutting back from work. Well, who's got the either higher paying job or the job with more benefits? That was what happened in my family. So I stayed the full-time caregiver and my husband cut back on his work so that he could be, I stayed the full-time wage earner and he cut back on his work so he could be more of the caregiver. So clearly there's a wide variety, right? And their needs are huge. The mental health needs of Americans in general have been increasing for quite some time. We've already established there's a heightened risk of depression and anxiety in the caregiver community, as we've talked about in other shows. How do we make sure that we are developing and providing evidence-based programs that are for family caregivers themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I have to tell you, starting 25 years ago, that was always my mantra. I started a program at Oklahoma State called Replenishing the Caregiver, which focused entirely on the caregiver, not the care recipient, because burnout rates are atrocious. And then, of course, the health indicators do demonstrate that caregivers oftentimes themselves become ill or financially strained. I mean, all these sorts of outcomes that if a better plan's in place, particularly for replenishment and respite yourself, then of course that's going to lead to better outcomes. One of the programs that we do fund at the federal level is a respite program that's designed to help caregivers step away, replenish themselves before they have to pick that duty right back up. And those vouchers that are used in that program help pay for somebody else to step in during that time. And I can't stress enough, most family caregivers go into a situation thinking that they're just going to manage all of it, that they'll be able to handle it, that their shoulders are broad enough, and that their capabilities are significant enough to manage the crisis at hand. And oftentimes that's just a failure of proper planning and acknowledging that that this often takes a team. You need to be talking right up front about who will be your backup, who's going to help you do certain things, and then how you're going to manage the overall experience for the one that you love. Because at the same time, people fail to acknowledge what value is it if the person you care for is doing okay, but yet your health goes down the toilet. And then all of a sudden you've taken a situation where there's one person in poor health and now you've made it two people in poor health. And that's not the goal of these programs and why we support family caregivers.
Right. That's an excellent point. And we had a guest last week. We always ask this question, what is one thing that you would want all caregivers to know? And almost everyone says that you are not alone. And this particular person said, you can't do this alone, which isn't an insult, but just such a good reminder. If I was to tell you I was going to open a restaurant and be the hostess, the waiter, the server, the cook, the business manager, you would look at me like I'm crazy. Yet this can be a full or part-time job, and a lot of people just assume that they can take it on their own.
Yep. Goal four hits home for both of us because it addresses how family caregivers' lifetime financial and employment security needs to be protected and enhanced. Liza really recognized it when she realized that her Social Security had been greatly impacted due to the fact that she was a caregiver for her son and had to take herself out of the workforce for periods of time. For me, it's been an incredible challenge. Like I just said, I kept that professional job because I had the better benefits, but I also am wanting to be really involved in Nicole's care. And both of those are full-time jobs, right? So what do you feel are some of the best recommendations to address how to protect our financial and employment needs? You just talked about our own personal, like mental health, make a team, but what are some things that we can do to actually help us in that financial realm as well?
Yeah, and that's a critical one. And that's a big part of the RAISE report. And I'm sure you've read that really, again, separates out this matter into kind of two issues. One does have to do with congressional levers, things that Congress could do around Social Security and other programs. And again, I think that cannot be overlooked. Now, that's not going to be an easy ship to turn overnight. Those are big conversations to have, but so critical. I think the other is a workforce-specific one. How can employers actually lean in to help create some sort of resiliency and support for their working caregivers who they value, and they want to make sure that they stay with the company long-term? And yet, so few of them actually step in to help with this kind of short-term obligation of taking care of things and what that financial burden looks like.
Excellent point. And we'll come back right after this short break to talk a little bit more about specifically what could employers do.